Good afternoon, everyone. We're going to get started in just a minute here. My name is Molly Marin. I am the webinar coordinator for the New York State RTI Technical Assistance Center. We're happy to have all of you with us today, and those who have been with us throughout the strand, we really appreciate you coming back. Today, the PowerPoint is available on our webpage. If you want to grab that and follow along, you're welcome to do so. At the end of today's presentation, I will post a link to an evaluation. If you could please take a few minutes to complete that, we really appreciate the feedback. Also, throughout today's webinar, feel free to use the chat box for any questions or comments that you may have. Dr. Johnson will be monitoring that throughout, and there will be some time at the end for questions as well. Today is the last in our middle school series. Please stay tuned to our webpage for some upcoming strands. We're very excited about some upcoming topics we have, and as soon as those are approved, they'll be posted to our webpage with registration links, and they are happening very soon. We anticipate the first one mid-November. One will deal with understanding RTI in mathematics, and the other is database decision-making in the RTI process. So we're very excited about those upcoming webinars, and we do hope that you'll come back and join us for those. Today's topic is characteristics of successful RTI models in middle schools. And we're very pleased to have back with us again today Dr. Evelyn Johnson. Dr. Johnson is a professor of special education at Boise State University and the executive director of the Lee Pesky Learning Center, a nonprofit organization whose mission is to improve the lives of people with learning disabilities. Dr. Johnson is a screening tool review committee member for the National Center for Response to Intervention and co-author of three books, all published by Corwin Press: Identification and Evaluation of Learning Disabilities, How RTI Works in Secondary Schools, and RTI, A Practitioner's Guide to Implementation. And at this time, I would like to introduce Dr. Evelyn Johnson.
Thanks, Molly, and good afternoon to everybody, and thanks for signing in to this number five of our series of five webinars on RTI in middle school. You can see by this slide, for those of you who may not have been able to attend all of them, we discussed a lot of things over the last several weeks. And today we're going to essentially wrap up the conversation by saying, okay, you know, we've spent a lot of time, a lot of resources, a lot of energy into implementing this RTI process. How do we know whether or not it's making a difference? And do we have to wait for results to show up in standardized testing, or are there ways that we can evaluate our implementation and get some formative assessment data on whether we've accomplished the goals that we set out to address? So we've talked over the last several weeks about the purpose of RTI really being designed to ensure that we are developing a responsive instructional system to meet the needs of all of our students and to serve both in a preventive capacity, so making sure that we are identifying kids early on in the process who appear to be at risk for poor academic outcomes, and to also ensure that we have an ongoing intervention system, because we know that by middle school, you know, we'll have kids coming into our system who have already gone through elementary school and already have the beginning of that achievement gap formed, especially in reading and in math. And so in designing our system throughout this series of webinars, we've talked about the need to collect data and to evaluate data and let data about our student needs and about our student performance really drive every decision that we make about how we structure our intervention system, who gets intervention services, and how we determine whether or not a student's being responsive to those intervention services. And so now we're going to take a look at how, through the use and collection of that data, we can also make some decisions about whether our system is really helping us meet the needs of our diverse student population. Okay. So about 5 years ago, Ed Shapiro and Nate Clemens, they were both at Lehigh at the time. I think Nathan has moved around a couple times. I think I can't remember where he is these days. I think he's at Auburn, but don't quote me on that. They published a really helpful article in the journal Assessment for Effective Intervention, where they really put together this very pragmatic conceptual model for how they were focused at the district level, how a school district could look at the various assessments and benchmarks and progress monitoring data and state outcome data and look at it not from the lens of making decisions about students, but really from that broader picture of, is RTI working? And so that article has really served as the foundation for today's talk. But I also wanted to emphasize that a few years ago when we were working with a school district at both the middle and high school level, we used their conceptual model as a framework for both the school and district level evaluation and helped a district put together a standard operating procedure or an SOP for how they were going to get their school leaders together and really look at data collectively, all with that eye towards ensuring that the system that they had developed through the RTI model was really leading to gains for all of their kids, and that was across elementary, middle, and high school level. So I'll be kind of switching back and forth from, as we go through today's webinar, both from the conceptual information to what it looked like in a real world setting. So I hope that's helpful for everyone. And as usual, as we go along, if you have questions, please feel free to jump in and I'll do my best to answer. So what this slide shows is really just the foundations for how they put the conceptual model together. So they, Ed Shapiro and Nate said, okay, let's take a look at what the key elements or the key components of our RTI model are. And then if we were to come to some decision about those components, what would that look like? Like what would be the way in which we evaluated that component? And so they identified these three main areas. So they actually called their first one Universal Benchmarks and Progress Monitoring, and I just condensed it to assessments. And the evaluation index there is really looking at whether we have changes over time in kids who are presenting at various risk levels, and whether we have changes over time that are consistent with anticipated growth in terms of what are our rates of improvement, right? Because our goal is to get more kids who only need tier one support, right? To me, that's sort of the big picture of what we're trying to accomplish. And then the next component we need to look at is how effective is our instruction and our intervention. And there we can take a look at what movement between tiers looks like. And so we've talked a lot, whenever we talk about RTI, it seems like we're always talking about moving from tier one to the need for tier two. And then if you're not responsive to a potential need for tier three. And we almost never talk about it from the other direction. And yet that's one of those goals that we all have for RTI, right? It's the reason why we put the system in place in the first place, right? That we hope that our tier two, for example, is effective enough that our kids will make gains to the point where they no longer need that support. And so one of the things we want to monitor is to what extent are we moving kids not only to higher levels of intensity of instructional support, but also back down to lower levels of intensity. And then, so that's sort of the big picture of movement, but that's not a very sensitive measure, right? But there are going to be a lot of kids who are making progress or not making progress that isn't necessarily going to result in a shift between those tiers, but we still want to be able to monitor what movement within those tiers looks like, okay? So, and this is especially true for our tier three or our special education. So we don't want to set up a system in which special education or tier three is viewed as, some form of end point on this increasingly intensive level of instruction. And once we get there, we no longer have expectations for student performance, right? We want to avoid that. One way we can do that is to ensure that we also anticipate growth and movement within those more intense levels of intervention. So once a student is receiving services in Tier 3, overall or in the aggregate, are we seeing positive upward movement in their performance levels? And then finally, RTI was really started within the special education system and soon realized that the RTI framework doesn't work unless we have a very solid general education instructional environment. And so was one of those initiatives that sort of got moved into the broader discussion of education. And yet one of the reasons for even, getting started with RTI was that there was this concern that referrals to special education were sometimes unfounded, right? So that principle of a disability or a lack of performance not being due to inadequate instruction, it was one of those things that we checked on our, IEP or referral forms, but that we didn't really have any substantive method of ensuring that the student had received that high quality instruction. And so RTI really helps provide that system of accountability and continuous improvement across all tiers of instruction with another goal of ensuring that we're only identifying kids who truly are disabled as in need of special education. And so another metric that we may want to check in our system is how accurate do we think the decisions about special ed referrals and evaluations are now that we've got a much more responsive system in place. So that's what the conceptual model looks like in the big picture. And now what we'll do is we'll take a look at each of the five evaluation indices separately. We'll look at what is the key question that we're trying to answer within that evaluation index, and then I'll show you an example of what the data might look like that we use to help answer that question. Okay? So if we start with our first index, it's monitoring risk levels across our benchmark periods. And so here the key question that we're trying to answer is, across our fall, our winter, our spring benchmark time periods, what percentage of our students are scoring at low risk? So those are our kids we're not worried about, some risk or at risk levels. Okay? And so an example of what our data might look like is a really simple bar chart, right? And so This is actual data from a school we've worked with looking at their reading performance over time. Okay. And so what you'll see is that they started with just over 60% of their kids in the fall able to meet the grade level benchmarks. They had about 15% in that strategic area, and they actually had over 20% of their kids scoring in the intensive range. Okay, so their RTI percentages are somewhat off, right? They don't have enough kids reading at grade level. This was a junior high we worked at, so this is seventh grade data, and they have a disproportionate number of students who are unable to even score in that strategic range. Okay, so we worked with them on putting a school-wide reading focus into place, and over the winter, you see that they made some really strong gains in their benchmark performance, right? So by winter, they were closer to 70%, and they had that strategic and intensive range in at levels that are much more consistent with what we hope to see in terms of percentage of students within tiers. And then by spring, their spring data looked a lot like their winter data. They made some gains in the kids able to reach benchmark, but they're still ending the year at just over 75%, right? Considering where they started, they did a tremendous job. But what's likely to happen now with this group of kids is they go home for the summer, and then in the fall we see that same decrease in reading performance. And so one of the things that this school concluded was that overall they had a fairly effective reading instructional program in place, but what they really wanted to do was start to put in some summer or extended year alternatives to help get them to that higher starting place in the fall, so that every time the kids came back, they weren't essentially starting over. Okay. And so this data, again, we talk a lot about data, and as part of an organization here that, we're responsible all the time for program evaluation and for reporting to grant agencies and to donors and through our annual reports. Data collection and analysis and evaluation is a time-consuming task. And so what I think is so valuable about all of these evaluation indices is that they come from data you're already collecting. You're just simply really looking at them from a different, through a different lens, I guess, than what we do when we're focused on individual student performance, if that makes sense. Okay. So then we moved to evaluation index 2. And here, the marker that we're looking for is, what is our rate of improvement across benchmark periods? And so, we can frame this evaluation question in several ways. And so here we have, what's the average rate of improvement, that's our ROI, for all students in a grade between two benchmark periods? Okay? And if you just think about what we're trying to get at is really this overall indication of growth. So is our overall instructional program benefiting our students on this one very general measure, okay? And then how does that rate of improvement compare to what we anticipate growth would look like based on normative growth rates, okay? And how does it compare to previously observed growth rates? So That second question is taking a look at our own improvement levels relative to published state or national norms. And that third question, how does it compare to previously observed growth rates, would be an historical look at our data. So last year or in the past 5 years, how much growth have we witnessed? Because we want to be able to see whether or not we are at least meeting, if not exceeding, anticipated growth levels in our foundational areas. And here's an example of what that data might look like. And I kept it very simple so that we could kind of get used to the concept. I started to put together all of the information that we had from a school from sixth through eighth grade, and I had high school, and it suddenly the table got very complex. So I thought, okay, I'm just going to focus on sixth grade data to explain how to use this, and then you can easily imagine how you could add grade levels, and if you're benchmarking in writing, for example, how you could add different content areas. And so what this table shows is that for grade six, the top line, the reading, oral reading fluency, is the 50th percentile benchmarks for easy CBM passages. Okay, so this was a school that uses the easy CBM norms. Sorry, the word was escaping me. So if you use Dibbles or you use AIMSWeb or you use any one of a number of other measures, you would want to use those norms. This school chose to measure their benchmarks against 50th percentile. I think it's a reasonable it's a reasonable decision. We encourage schools to actually put more of a range up there. And again, in the name of simplicity, I haven't done that here. But sometimes putting somewhere between the 25th and 50th gives us a much better idea of what what the range of performance might look like. And then this second row is school level data, right? So you'll see in the fall where 50th percentile is 138 words read correct. For this school, their average score for sixth grade was 115, okay? Which means they've got some work to do, right? And then you can just see it progress from winter to spring. So if we just looked at those numbers, we might conclude that the school was actually doing a really poor job of improving reading because they end up still 23 words behind, which is kind of where they started. And so the other metric that we want to calculate is their growth rate. So how many words read correct per week does a gain from 138 to 163 end up? And it ends up being right about 0.7 of a word. And when we calculated the same for this school, they were also making same levels of growth. So not doing a terrible job in terms of growth, but where they really needed to spend some time and energy is getting that overall performance level up to speed, okay? And then the same pattern held true for math. So this school also decided to use easy CBM benchmarks in math and use the same kind of decision rules. They took the 50th percentile and used those as sort of their target and then plotted their own student performance against those. And what you'll see in math that was really encouraging was that they actually outstripped the pace of growth relative to national norms. Now, admittedly, not by a lot, but they still were able to close the gap, right? So whereas in the fall, on average, they started about 7 math problems behind, they closed that gap to just 5 on the easy CBM measures. So that gave them some indication that what they were doing for math was effective. And so based on this review, they decided to implement, to, you know, just continue implementation as is. Okay. When we move to the next evaluation index, here's where we want to look at that question of that movement between tiers. So how many students moved to either a less or a more intensive tier between benchmark periods? Okay. So this is sample data from a junior high we worked with this model. And if we look at the left side of the chart, so the left side of that black line, what that indicates is what percentage of students moved to a more intensive tier over the school year. And this was for both reading, reading is in blue, and for math, which is in yellow. Okay. So you'll see that they had about the 12% of their kids identified as needing tier two support in reading, in addition to general ed or core instruction, and about 15% in math. Okay, so those numbers seem pretty reasonable, right? When we think about that RTI triangle and the percentages of students we anticipate needing support, they're well within that range. Okay, and then they also monitored what percentage of students over the school year moved from tier two to tier three. Okay. So within tier two, so that's the second grouping on the left side of the black line, within tier two, they had 15% of the students within tier two ending up moving to needing tier three services, okay? And in math, 30% of their students who were in tier two ending up needing more intensive services. So what this indicated, if you think about it, if you apply the same sort of logic that we apply to the expectations for tier one to tier two, right, we expect somewhere around 80 to 85% of our kids to be okay with core instruction alone. So if we think about, okay, so now we've got this group of kids in tier two, what's a reasonable expectation for how many kids should respond to my tier two instruction? And so what this chart shows is that over 80% of their kids receiving tier two in reading were fine with tier two, and they were responding, and they did not need to move on to that more intensive level. But only 70% of their kids for math responded well to the tier two program. Okay. Now, it may very well be that they had a higher percentage of kids with math, with intensive math needs. But when we looked at the data this way, thankfully that wasn't their conclusion. Their conclusion was, we really need to take a look at what's happening in our tier two math program, because it doesn't appear as if it's sufficiently meeting the needs of the kids who receive services there. Okay. And that's sort of echoed on this other, on now the right side, right? So what the right side shows is what is the movement from a more intensive tier to a less intensive tier, okay? So here they were able to move lots of kids out of tier two back to tier one, right? So almost a quarter of their kids within the school year were able to move out of tier two, okay? And again, that you know, depending on our numbers and what individual progress looks like, but the school was pretty happy with that, right? That given the incoming level of the disparities in their kids who needed that individual support, they were able to get a decent number of students back on track and needing no additional support besides what was happening in core instruction. Those numbers are a lot lower for math. And when we look at moving kids out of the really intensive support from tier three, they were able to do that for a sizable percentage of kids getting reading support, but for zero kids getting math support. Okay. So overall, what this chart told that school was that they really, really needed to take a much closer look at what their math instructional program was like, to include lots of different factors, right? So to look at what were the kids coming into school with, right? So that if there were some key gaps missing, they could then communicate to their largest feeder elementary schools and work the problem that way in terms of like a vertical alignment of the curriculum. And then they also now can look at their intervention and what are they, you know, how are they providing it? Are they providing it with sufficient intensity? Are they, and frequency? Are they using a highly qualified instructor, right? So all of the things that we looked at in our Tier 2 program especially, they can now go back and they have data to show that they really need to spend a little more time there to make sure that their kids end up making better progress in math. Okay. When we move to evaluation index number 4, here's where we can answer or ask the question about movement within tiers. And so some of the things that we might ask is, you know, what's the average attained rate of improvement on progress monitoring measures for students in both tiers 2 and 3? How does that rate of improvement compare to the average targeted rate of improvement for that group? Okay, so in tier 2, remember that we said if the purpose of our tier 2 system is to really address some functional academic skills gaps and in order to get kids back into tier 1, then we need to set rates of improvement that lead us to end of year or end of intervention period performance levels that are consistent with grade level performance. Okay. So for tier 2, this is a much easier task, right? Because we kind of have all of our kids shooting for the same target, which is getting them to grade level. Okay. And so then we can compute an average rate of improvement needed based on the students that we have in our tier 2 program. Okay. But when it comes to tier 3, it's a little trickier because once a student is in that more intensive level of intervention, we might set different rates of improvement and different performance targets based on the severity of that student's discrepancy and on, you know, the intensity of their instructional need. And so for tier 3, when we talk about average targeted rate of improvement, it should really be based on our student population who we're serving in tier 3. And it's really important that we're setting ambitious but realistic goals. And that's really hard to do in tier 3. And so it really takes some more, you know, looking at the individual student level and ensuring that we are setting growth targets that really mirrors the expectation that students are going to make growth in Tier 3. Okay, so there are lots of different ways that we can look at this particular question and the data that we achieve. So here's a movement within tiers over one school year. Okay, so what this shows is that for Tier 2, we had a targeted rate of improvement of increasing by one word read correctly per week. Okay, that's that gray bar on the left, on the far left here. And when we go through and we computed our rate of improvement average for our Tier 2 group, you see that we really didn't do very well in terms of what we attained and where we targeted our ROI. And so based on this data, we would conclude that our Tier 2 actually was not as effective as we had hoped it would be in terms of our Tier 2 intervention and the levels of growth that we were able to help our students realize. Okay? And the importance of this is that if, you know, if you think about it, our kids who are entering Tier 2 are already behind. And so not only do they have to make, you know, continue to make typical growth rates, but they really have to exceed. If the goal is to catch them up to grade level, they actually have to exceed typical rates of improvement, right? And so so that one is an increase in what's typical, and yet we're not even hitting what's expected, right? So if we, I'm going to flip back for a second to let everybody. So here we see that typical growth is about 0.7, right? Words read correct per week, okay? And so our average targeted was 1, which would have helped us close the gap, right? Because the kids are, over the course of a year, would end up gaining some, you know, not only the 0.7, but then an additional 0.3 words per week if we multiply that out across 36 weeks, we would get something along the lines of 12 additional words, right? So again, all in the name of closing that gap. And so now, not only have we not met our ambitious targets, but we haven't even gotten our kids to make an average rate of improvement that's consistent with the general population, which means that not only are we not closing their gap, but it's actually getting bigger, okay? So that's a real problem for us here. And so this really warrants investigating what is happening at Tier 2 in terms of instruction and an investigation about, you know, like, why aren't these kids making growth and what do we need to do better, okay? If you look at Tier 3, however, here we're making very close, we're attaining very close to targeted rates of improvement, okay? And so I might still want to investigate why we're off, right? Because even though 0.2 doesn't look like a huge gap, if you, again, if you multiply it across a school year and you factor in that our Tier 3 kids are really starting low, not making that ambitious level of growth means that they continue to fall further and further behind as well. On the other hand, the discrepancy is nowhere near as big in the Tier 3 as it is in the Tier 2. And so in terms of a priority, right, now the school has some data to say, I'm going to put my immediate attention and resources into fixing my Tier 2 issue first. Okay. I was going to say, does that make sense to everybody? But I can't see you, so I'm assuming it does. Otherwise, you'd ask me questions. Okay, so now we go and to our final evaluation index, and here we're taking a look at the question of, you know, when we refer a student for special education, how many or what percentage of those students that we referred actually ended up qualifying for services? Okay, and in when we work with schools at the elementary level, it's usually an initial referral. By the time we get to middle school, we're looking both at initial, some initial for like our late emergent reading disabled kids or kids that come in from different districts or different states. But we could also be looking at reevaluations, right? So if, for example, a student came from a school that did not have a strong RTI process, we still have lots of possibilities, I guess, for students to be incorrectly identified as in need of special ed services, in particular as a child who's presenting with a learning disability. And when we go for reevaluation, if we have a strong RTI system implemented in our school, we may find that we're able to address some needs in a tier two system, right? And so the data here is really just a simple percentage of how many kids were referred for special education, and then of that number referred, how many actually were found to be eligible for special ed services. And here the goal is to get 100%, right? Because we want, what we hope our RTI process does for us is it gives us a very conclusive and very systematic way of helping to ensure that a child's lack of achievement is not due to inadequate instruction. And the way we do that is through that comparison of here is what general performance for the reference group is. So in my core instructional program, for example, if I have, you know, my 85% of my students meeting grade level targets, that's a pretty good indication to us that our instruction is generally effective. If we have a tier two system where only, you know, I don't know, 50% of my kids are responding to tier two intervention, I don't want to say that, you know, then there's no way that we should be referring kids for tier three. But if we only have a 50% success rate in our tier two program, we might want to take a closer look at our tier two program and make sure that we've really designed an intervention system that, you know, we can reasonably expect kids to make growth in. Okay. And so if we find that our number, our percentage here for special ed placements is, you know, much lower than 100%, it means that we have students going through the system and there has to be some other explanation for why they're not responding. Okay. And that could lead us to look at things like attendance, like behavior, you know, other kinds of issues besides the possibility that it's a within child problem. Okay. So when we talk about implementing this kind of process, I'm laughing to keep from crying because to me, when I read Ed's article and saw this model, I thought, oh my gosh, this makes perfect sense to me. You know, I can easily see how all of these different questions would help answer important questions about student concerns, but then at a school level or at a district level, also help me determine whether or not I was really doing a good job with this RTI process. And I don't know if it's because I had already spent a lot of time working within an RTI system or, you know, prior to my life in education, I was a staff officer in the military. And so this notion of presenting metrics as an indication of how well you were doing was, you know, I don't know that second nature is the right word, but it was something I had been, you know, I was quite used to. And so it made total sense because I thought, okay, well, I want to know, you know, at the school level, I want to know if there are adjustments I need to make in terms of what staff assignments I have, in terms of my scheduling, in terms of program or instructional delivery. And at the district level, I want to see, you know, in the aggregate, in my system at the district level, are my individual schools really being consistently responsive to student needs? Do we have a persistent area that's presenting challenges to us? Do we have some areas, so for example, do we have a school or two schools that seem to be doing things quite well and other schools within my district who are not? And if so, can I use a lessons learned type approach to why are things working in one school compared to the other, right? So this whole reporting on metrics and data on a routine basis can really be used to inform the system at multiple levels. So I've presented so much of our information on RTI really at the school level because that's where so much of the detailed implementation work needs to happen. But what this evaluation process can do is really serve multiple purposes across that larger notion of system. So we can look at it at grade levels, we can look at it at school levels, and then we can look at it at district levels. Okay. So all that, it was really easy to say and really to think about, okay, what would the process be? And it was extremely hard to get into place in the when we tried to take it to the district level. So we came with this notion that, you know, if we're requiring schools to collect and evaluate this data anyway, don't you want to see it at the district level so that you really know, you know, not in real time, but, you know, in sufficient time, what school performance is looking like, so that you get that picture across your district, so that you can make decisions about, you know, how and where and when to allocate different resources. Right? And we actually got quite a bit of pushback from the district level initially for multiple reasons. And so one concern that the district had was, you know, we're not in the habit of having our school principals share their data. And we don't want them, you know, with all the other demands and you know, there are other things happening in our state at the time, you know, it was during like the recession. I mean, there were a lot of good reasons why they didn't want to add one more stress to the building leader. And we said, you know, there is a way to structure this process so that it's really done in the name of improvement and in the name of the district wanting to make sure that they are providing the support to the building level as needed. So it took a lot of convincing, and even took us modeling a district level meeting. At least, I know we did it twice, and I want to say three times, where we went and instead of the district leadership running the meeting, they asked if we would do it so they could get a sense of what it would look like. But also they felt that with, someone serving in more of a consultant capacity, that principals would view it more as a process and less as a performance evaluation. Okay. So what we did was at the school level, we encouraged the RTI teams to collect the kind of data that we just went through across grade levels and ask them to review it to come to their own decisions about RTI efficacy. So it wasn't just bring your data to the district level so we can look at it and talk about it. It was, we want you to collect and review and analyze your data, and we want you to tell us what you're doing in response to this, to include indicating what supports you might need from the district level, right? And when you frame it that way, then the schools can take ownership of the process, but they also recognize that the primary reason that they're engaging in this process is so that they have, it provides a mechanism to say, like, here's what I've done, here's what I've been able to accomplish, here are the results. Where I've not been able to achieve the intended results, here are the things I think would help, and here are the resources I am going to need from the district in order to get me there, right? And all of a sudden you can see how that mindset is way different than why aren't you hitting, why are your kids not hitting performance targets? So we worked with the schools to prepare their data in that way, and then at the district level, we set up quarterly updates during which the school principals would come. And just like we had that standing agenda for data review at the school level and the different tier levels, we had the same process put into place at the district level, except they're looking at school level data. Okay. So the next three slides, I actually broke up. This is one worksheet that is included within that article that I cited that Ed and Nate included as just one example of a worksheet that schools could use to help them organize the data collection process, right? Because sometimes, thinking through what to present and how to present it, it can be a little overwhelming. And so what this data organization worksheet does is really just give you a way to, keep track of the stuff that you're supposed to be reporting. And so these first two boxes that are shown on this slide relate to those first two evaluation indices. So where we're just putting percentages of kids at different benchmarks, we're indicating whether we've made improvement, and we have a place to put comments and observations. And then on the second one, we're putting information about rates of improvement. So this screenshot actually comes from their article. We did find in our work with schools that people got really kind of hung up with how to fill that out, and so instead we just went to that table that I showed you on the earlier slide where we just put, here's what the benchmarks are, here's how many weeks passed, here's the average rate of improvement. Okay. This next slide shows the data collection tools for evaluation index number 3. So this is simply that question of movement, so how many students move to a less or more intensive tier between benchmark periods. And here you'll also see this is really only for one academic area. And so what we did with the district we worked with is we just, you know, replicated this for, because they were monitoring in both reading and math. And then for number four, this is just our average rate of improvement on progress monitoring measures for both tier two and tier three. And finally, a simple place to document our accuracy levels for students receiving special ed services. Okay, so this is just a simple tool to help organize the school's thinking about what data to collect and how to put it together in a format that would allow them to create the kinds of visuals that I've included in our presentation today that just make it so much easier and user-friendly to review data than you can when it's numbers written down on a worksheet. Okay. So with that, I hope what we've been able to accomplish over this series is, you know, an understanding of how the process of RTI works at the secondary school, you know, what the components look like, how to address some of the fine-tuned details of RTI implementation to include, you know, how do I make decisions about assessment tools, about instruction and intervention programs, and then how do I organize it in terms of my schedule, what kinds of processes and procedures can I use to make sure I'm getting efficient use of my meeting and my leadership time. And finally, what I hope today's session leaves you with is just some ways to think about how you can conduct that ongoing evaluation without having to wait to see if it turns up in state assessment scores, okay? We have a lot of schools that, you know, kind of get in that mindset of, well, I'll just get, you know, through this, my outcome will be more kids meeting proficiency level on my state exams. And that's a wonderful goal, but it's not a very sensitive measure. And if you don't see a lot of movement there, you can erroneously conclude that your RTI system really isn't making a difference. And so what these evaluation metrics help with, I think, is it just gives you that finer grain look at whether or not you really are seeing impact and it just hasn't yet had enough time to show up in those less sensitive measures, or whether there is really a problem with implementation that warrants further investigation, right? Which is probably a better approach than saying my kids' scores aren't moving or improving and therefore I am not going to bother with this RTI implementation. With all the schools that we've looked, that we've worked with, when we've looked at this finer analysis of data, I'm going to knock on wood here, but we haven't worked with a school yet that hasn't been able to see some pretty significant improvements in reading and or math performance on a variety of different measures. And so it really helps, those sensitive measures really help to keep staff engaged in the process as well, right? Because it's hard to keep doing something if you don't see any marked improvement. And so when we look at data this way, it helps us see improvement more frequently. And yes, it's on a smaller scale than maybe a state assessment, but that keeps us motivated to keep at it. So I hope that's what you walk away with from this series of presentations. I really hope that they've been helpful. And I wanted to end a little bit earlier than normal so that if you had questions either on anything I presented today or over the last 5 weeks, or really, pretty much anything about RTI in middle school, that all of you would have the opportunity to ask those questions now. Okay, so Margaret's question is, how do you establish rates of improvement for Tier 2 and Tier 3? So for Tier 2, again, working under the assumption that our goal in Tier 2 is to get kids back into the core instructional program, we always encourage schools to set performance targets that are consistent with grade level performance standards, right? So if we're looking at reading data, for example, norms for, we want to use norms that get us within the average range of performance for that grade level. And so anywhere above 25% is within the average range, right? And so we can set kind of like a band of performance levels. So in the example that I showed here earlier, the school chose to use the 50th percentile. Now, I think it's a little high because the 50th percentile is, right, it's different than, people always get confused with 50% and 50th percentile. So 50th percentile is a solid average. So to think that you're going to get all of your kids up to the 50th percentile, I think is unrealistic. And so creating sort of this confidence interval range, I guess, of performance that's still at grade level, anywhere from 25th to 50th. So you get like, right? So you get a low end and a high end average, and that's where you're shooting for, okay? And so on your rates of improvement for your progress monitoring, instead of having a single aim line, you can create an aim vector, I guess, for lack of a better term right now. So you have this range of growth that actually is a much more realistic picture of where we can expect or anticipate kids to be at the end of the school year, okay? And so that way, instead of making these sort of absolute decisions based on what may be unrealistic targets, right? So if we stick with the 50th, that may be too high, and we may erroneously conclude that our students aren't really making gains. What having this sort of vector approach does, that gives us that range between like 25th and 50th, is it lets us see when they're just barely above average. So it means like, okay, we've done a really good job and it's probably too soon to withdraw support. At the same time, if I have lots of students getting into that range, it means that I'm really seeing some solid growth for my kids, okay? And so that's the approach we try and take with our Tier 2 rates of improvement. And then we simply work backwards, right? So we get that range of performance and we subtract the student's starting point and divide it by the number of weeks that we're going to carry out the intervention, and that gives us our rate of improvement. Okay. I wish I had a whiteboard so I could have drawn all that for you as I was explaining. I hope that made sense, Margaret. If it didn't, I'll just trust that you're going to ask me to clarify. But that's our general approach for Tier 2. Now for Tier 3, Tier 3 is really, Tier 3 is challenging. I mean, I wish I had an easy solution for you. And so We've worked Tier 3 a couple different ways, and because we primarily work with kids who are in that intensive range here at the center that I work at, some of the ways that we've done it is if the student can register. Oh, you drew pictures. Oh, okay, great. If the student can register on a grade level passage, so this is for reading, and by register I mean get into like the 10th percentile or above, and it's not so frustrating that they shut down, we really encourage, and this is the practice we engage in here, that monitoring on grade level, because it's really difficult to interpret growth at lower grade levels, right? It's like, well, yeah, your child or the student is improving by this much, but that's on stuff that's, you know, about two grade levels or three grade levels below where we would like them to be reading, right? So that interpretation I always find is very, very challenging. So as much as possible, we advocate for reading at grade level. And again, we here at the center, I'll have to be honest with you, I have not been able to convince a school to do this. But what we do at the center is we set, for kids that we're monitoring only at grade level, we set their performance target for the 25th percentile at grade level. And that gives us what I think is, for some kids, it's probably overly ambitious, but in lots of cases, realistic goal for us to shoot for. And then we use that same process of backing out end of intervention period performance, starting point, and calculate the rate of improvement. So for kids who don't register on grade level above 10th percentile, we, you know, we go through that process of let's try grade, if we're talking about grade 6, let's go back to grade 5 and see where they register on grade 5, and then work backwards through the process so that we are monitoring at the highest possible grade level, right? Because what we used to have happen was, because it is, you know, it is terribly frustrating to watch a child who struggles read a passage that is obviously difficult for them, and it's so much easier to monitor at much lower grade levels to facilitate the reading. But that's not really, you know, that's not what we're trying to do here. We're trying to see, like, are we seeing growth that's going to help them improve? And so for Tier 3, again, we work through that backwards process so that we're monitoring at the highest grade level possible. Then if we are monitoring at a grade level below where they are, then we'll set our final performance target. We'll repeat that same process that I just described for Tier 2, where we'll make a band between the 25th and 50th. Okay? And so the rationale behind that very complicated answer is I really feel it's important that, to the extent possible, we encourage growth to grade level standards, right? That's what we all hope to accomplish. And at the same time that we have that ability to make adjustments based on individualized needs, but that we make those adjustments in a way that's really going to keep us pushing that student forward and keep, prevent us from saying, well, you know, they're reading at a third grade level, and so I'm going to monitor at third grade level. That to me is not helpful. And so that's a very long answer, I know. And I guess if I had to summarize it, like, if I encourage people, monitor as close to grade level as possible, and then shoot for that that confidence interval between our low average, which is what the 25th percentile represents, to our solid average of 50th percentile as our performance target. Okay. And we advocate that so that we maintain high expectations for our students and so that we don't slip into that trap of saying, well, they're in tier three. So I'm going to just start him at grade three passages or, you know, whatever sort of arbitrary decision gets made there. I feel like that was a very complicated response. I hope it was, I hope I had answered your question. let's see, Patricia is typing another. Okay, so Patricia is saying, how would you approach a child who's an English language learner who's on a kindergarten level for reading? Well, you know, Patricia, we do it in much the same way that I just described. So I'm going to try and avoid like getting into a long, long detailed explanation again. But we kind of do the same process, right? Here we would probably have greater expectations for growth if we believe that it's a language issue and not also a reading disability issue. Okay. And so you know, obviously depending on what the second language is, we may try and get measures in the student's native language if they have literacy in their native language. And if not, I would actually use a process really similar to the one that I just described for Margaret, except I would probably shoot for a little bit higher than the 25th level, and I would anticipate reaching it faster than I would for a student who's receiving special ed services. I was waiting to see if you were typing something else. So I hope I addressed that question okay for you. There's, you know, I'm trying, it's admittedly been probably about 6 months since I looked at the research on progress monitoring for students who are English language learners. From some work I did years ago with the Florida Center for Reading Research, we did find that when we use different benchmarks for different subgroups, of which English language learners were one of those subgroups, we found that we needed to set lower benchmarks were more accurate in terms of predicting who was at risk, right? And so, and it was interesting because the feedback we got when we published that was, so are you saying we need to have lower expectations for our students who are English language learners? And we said, no, actually, you know, it kind of suggests just the opposite, that that even if we get kids who are English language learners to levels of fluency, that are consistent with grade level, it doesn't, that's great, but it doesn't necessarily mean that their sort of mastery of reading, given all the other things that come into play in terms of language and comprehension and vocabulary, are in place. So we're going to actually cast a wider net to identify more kids as potentially at risk and in need of intervention. But what that means is that the intervention doesn't necessarily have to, or should it, focus on decoding, and rather where kids who are English language learners are probably going to need more help is in the area of vocabulary and comprehension. So, okay, so I see Molly's posted the link for the survey. Oh, and I see I might have one more question, so I'm going to I'll make sure I wait. Oh, Kathleen's saying very helpful. Okay. Well, thank you. And thanks to all of you, and thanks to Molly and Teresa for giving me the opportunity to work with all of you over these last 5 weeks. I really enjoyed it. Hope it was helpful, and hope if you have questions as you go along the process, you'll reach out and email, and I'll do what I can to answer.